This is the Reverend Alan MacArthur, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 12th of April 2011. The Reverend Alan MacArthur, Part 2. In your second year, you were sent to Argentine Islands.
That's correct, yes.
What was your first impression of seeing that base?
The voyage down there was very spectacular, I thought, going through Lemur Channel and doing that. It was really very interesting to see where we were going to be for the following year. Argentine base was, first impressions, I thought Wordy House, as it was called, didn't look much of a house, but anyway, it was fine, so there was no problem there. As always, when we get to a place like that, and of course every time the biscuit came in, you had to spend a whole day offloading all kinds of oil drums and loads of anthracite bags of it and what have you. So you certainly had to do your best to get everything ashore in time. I think the big problem with Argentine and Ireland was that sometimes it got iced up very quickly around the boat, and the Biscoe may have to leave sooner than normal. But it didn't happen on that occasion. It happened later on, of course. And we got all the stuff ashore and humped to the base. Some we couldn't take the same day, but we left it for the dogs to haul it later on. And, I was quite glad to be there.
How did Wordy House compare as a living quarters to your previous bases?
Well, probably wasn't as... there wasn't as much room, for one thing. There were bunks up the side in the what was the sitting room, come kitchen, come everything. And we all had two bunks on each side, one in the middle. Probably not as comfortable, maybe, as Deception, or certainly not as comfortable as South Georgia. But it was adequate. It was fine.
You've been promoted.
Yeah. That's right.
You are now senior Met man.
That's right.
Did that make a difference?
Oh, quite a bit more responsibility, because then you were responsible for all the reports, and in particular the end of the year report, which was quite important, of what happened during the whole year. And the other thing, of course, in the Argentine Islands, there was much more opportunity for upper air work with the balloons, because the climate there was different in many ways. Probably the best of the bases for sunshine, for long spells of sunshine. But very stormy at times, mind you, the wind quite stormy. But we were always impressed upon when there was an opportunity to get a balloon up, that had to be done, because that gives you a lot more information, of course, than ground level, what's coming. And so we'd a special balloon shed there, and the balloons. And again, the wind was the problem, getting the balloon up. But it was very good. And you could follow a balloon there to amazing levels, you know, with a theodolite. You could hardly, last little speck. And this meant, of course, every time you did that, it was extra work for reporting back to Stanley. It had to go there more or less immediately, to the Met office in Stanley for processing.
Tell me a bit more about releasing the balloons from this shed. What were the tactics?
Well, you filled the balloon from a hydrogen cylinder, and then you had, obviously before that, you had to get the theodolite ready and gauged which way it was going to go when it took off. It wasn't much of a problem, because they're not as big as the balloons we had in upper air when I was based at Stornoway, because then these were massive balloons, you see. And I could tell you some stories about that, which will have to be kept quiet. But we didn't have a radio set attached to them. We had nothing attached to the ones, and everything depended on you following the balloon theodolites and the speed it was travelling, and the direction, and the change of direction, what have you. At every level. So it was quite a thing, because you had a slide rule, and every minute you had to do on a check out the whole process on the slide rule and hope you didn't lose the balloon in the meantime. So you had to get quite adept at that, and I found it was quite interesting to do that.
Just one man then?
Just one man was doing the whole thing.
So you couldn't keep your eye on it all the time?
No, and it required a lot of, attention and your mind working at the same time on the slide rule, as well as every minute, you see, had to put this onto the slide rule. So it was quite good.
Correct me if I got this wrong. Is this the base where they put a hole in the roof of the shed?
No, no. You take it out. We didn't even have a hole in the roof on the upper rear ones in Stornoway. It all had to come out. And sometimes, you had two people there, then one holding the transmitter at a certain level and direction, and the other letting the balloon off. And sometimes you had to run as fast as you could to make sure you didn't stick in a wire fence or something. But there was no problem like that.
Again, do you remember any particular extreme weather conditions that you were recording?
In the Argentine Islands, wind speeds sometimes were very extreme. If it went over 100 knots, you had to switch over, which we had an internal, for switching over to a double, it halved the
anemometer.
To make it, that's anemometer, that's right. And it gave you the actual speed then, whipped over 100 knots. And occasionally this happened. And it meant some days when that was the problem with the wind, you had to dig yourself out of the Wardy House because it just got covered completely. And we had a rope all the way up to the thermometers where we all had the for checking the temperature. While rainfall was pretty hopeless anyway, it was still snow. And if you went out in the night, of course, it was quite dark there most of the time in the winter, and you had to follow that rope and hope you didn't lose it, because the drifting snow was the big problem there. But we got through it all right.
So how was that winter? What was the sea ice like?
Sea ice was, plenty of sea ice that winter. It really was quite a thing, because we go sledging on the sea for miles and take the dogs out as well. And you could go right across to Grahamland, the other side, which occasionally, I was seldom away because of the fact that we lost Jock Tate there, you see. He had to be taken off.
What happened?
He and I used to go sailing every sort of twice a week. And Jock was quite an expert at that, see. And one of the days when we were gutting sail, he cut his finger. I was okay. I mean, it happens anyway. But then about a couple of days after that, he became very ill and his hand was all swollen. So we got in touch with Doc Marsh, was it? But in Hope Bay, he was the nearest doctor. And he advised us to give him so much penicillin, which we did, but it didn't seem to have any effect. And fortunately, the following day, a Chilean tug came in, the Leenter, and they had a doctor on board, and he came ashore, and we told him, and so he called it, it's a speck finger. It's a Norwegian term. They get this from seals or from whales or what have you, and it's very often fatal. But he gave him a tremendous boost of penicillin, and that helped. But the advice was he shouldn't be here. Get him out if possible. They were quite prepared to take him, but the Biscay was coming back within a matter of days anyway, so I decided to leave it till the Biscay came. He was taken away, so he wasn't replaced, so that was Jock. He was down to four.
Was his name also Murdo?
Murdo Finlayson and Tate.
Sorry?
Murdo Finlayson and Tate. That's Jock Tate.
Right.
Yeah.
Before he left, what sort of chap was he? Did you know him already before you arrived at...
Oh, I mean, I'd met him at Hope Bay. And we did a chat because when he heard I was from Lewis, he was a lighthouse... a keeper or something, and he'd been around most of the lighthouses on the west coast, and Murdo, we just called him Jock Tate, Murdo Finlayson Tate.
There was a chap called Norman Petts.
Norman Petts.
With you as well. And did he? There's a story about him, I believe.
He's a bass leader.
Oh, was he? Right, OK.
Kind of.
Go on, tell me the story.
I don't know. Norman was a... He was a... What do they call these people who go down caves again? You know,
a potholer.
Potholer. And, of course, the ruling is you mustn't go away from base on your own. There must be always two of you. And Petts, being base leader, should have had more sense. But he used to go off on his own, irrespective of this. And this day he went off and never came back. And those were very concerned because what could you do? So we went looking for him. And fortunately, we discovered him. He'd fallen off a nice shelf down onto the ice and broken an arm, wasn't it? I'm not sure. Anyway, he was injured, so we got him back to the base and we put him in a bath of hot water because he was suffering from hypothermia. And Norman was an odd fellow, but it didn't deter him from trying to do the same again. And we said, no way, Norman, you're not going to do it. But things went wrong with our member. You know, you had to empty the cooker, the ashes, every so often. And, of course, you had to take the ashes away. And we had a place down away from the base where you could put all the stuff, and it washed away of it. But Norman went to the... There was a small window at the side, and this morning he came out with the ashes. And he bashed through the window with the ashes. And we thought he'd gone something wrong with him. He said, what the mess going on? Anyway, he got over that, but he never should have been made best leader at all. And, of course, we had Norman Thayer, who was another problem.
Norman?
Thayer. Norman finished up as a professor of some kind in California. But very clever fellow, Norman, but probably after about 3-4 months, we began to see signs that things weren't what they should be. Norman died 2 years ago. I got a note of that. He used to come in every, wash his hands, dry his hands, 5 minutes, same again, you know, and this kind of thing was going on. And we got in touch with Doc Marsh, and he said, put him on phenobarbital for a while. See. So that helped a bit. But obviously he was not happy in himself, and it's difficult to know what to do. The only thing, he was fine, but he'd cook, you know, and that didn't seem to bother him. He'd do that fine. But he was supposed to be helping me with the med side. And that put an additional load, so we stopped doing night duties. So I kept doing it myself. But then, when he was ready to go, the Biscuit was going to come in two occasions. One, to load off stores, or they were going to build a new base at Hope Bay, which they began before I left. And the Biscoe couldn't get in. And, of course, Norman was hoping to get off on that trip. And when we were told the Biscoe couldn't get in, he was absolutely... Well, I tried to calm him down. He was really to the stage of screaming, you know. And he ran out of the base and away up the side of the hill on Skua Island. Of course, you could see from there right up to the Mayor Channel. And, of course, the Biscoe couldn't get in anywhere near. So anyway, we got him back to the hut and said, not to calm him down because she'll come back anyway eventually. And the next attempt, a couple of days after that, she got in. So Norman would have been a problem, really. We just wonder what would have happened if they hadn't been able to relieve us. Anyway, it worked out at the end of the day.
It sounded like it was a very harum-scarum winter that then, with these slightly unusual occurrences.
Yes, yes. I suppose you can expect things, you know, where there's only two or three and you're completely isolated. You know, if they haven't been accustomed to anything like that, or if their mindset is such that, well, I don't know. You had plenty of reading material if you wanted to, but other things, of course, you could have an interest in. And we always try to make things as interesting as possible for everyone. But obviously there are dangers, problems. I don't know how you get round it at the end of the day, but possibly maybe a bit more in the way of interviewing people to see what they can stand up to.
Bearing in mind you later became a minister, a pastor,
yeah.
Were there any latent skills inside you at that stage in your life which you could bring to bear upon the situation to make the waters more tranquil?
I think I learned a lot about people's attitudes, a lot of things that have been a help to me as a minister with regard to helping people overcome mental problems or whatever kind of problem. I did a course when I was being trained with the ministry, and our professor of practical theology thought it would be a good idea for us to have this short course in the hospital in Glasgow, Southern General. And he was a Jewish professor, I don't know what, psychiatry. And they had a unit there, and so he brought us in for some training on this matter. We were sitting behind a large screen, and people couldn't see us who were coming in for treatment, but we could see them. And some of the things that happened, as I say, in my time overseas, was very evident, you know, that this was quite helpful for dealing with problems of people in loneliness, people living alone, people who can't cope, and how do you deal with them? So it was, I felt it was quite a help to be there.
Were you able to help either of the two Normans at that time?
Oh, yes.
With what we now call counselling?
Yeah.
Can you recall anything about that? It's a long time ago, I appreciate.
Well, not really. I think probably was trying to keep him interested in some things, you know, that would be of help. Even reading, you know. And if you give him something specific to do, and you said, look, Norman, I must get this. That helped, as long as his mind was occupied with that particular thing.
You gave him a job?
Yes.
Yeah.
He wasn't any use for doing dogs or anything like that, you know. He wasn't a very strong fellow physically. He was quite a small, thin fellow.
This is Norman?
Norman Thayer. We were able to help him, fortunately. I always kept in touch with Norman, because I knew he'd gone, because he used to get his emails from him occasionally. But he passed away, and they never told me for long enough, and then I discovered that 2 years ago he'd passed away. In Vancouver, I think he was then.
Do you recall any scary incidents whilst you were south, where you were a bit worried about your longevity?
Well, Norman had a thing. You know Norman Thayer, we've just been talking about anything if he was in danger of any kind. And one of the things that he was absolutely not leopard seals, but killer whales.
Right.
And sometimes when we went out, particularly in the Argentine Islands, to get seals, and you had a seal up on an ice floe, and you went onto the ice floe, killed the seal, and its blood, you know, trickled right through, and then killer whales used to come round, certainly. On one occasion, Norman was with me, and who else was there at the time? Wasn't Norman Pets, no? Anyway, and Norman just went cracker, because it could have, you know, broken through, and he was absolutely screaming because of that. And anyway, we got him into the boat on the way back to the shore. But he had this thing about killer whales. And the other incident was in South Georgia, who went off on a hunt with the manager of the station, who was Norwegian. We went over in this large motorboat to the other side of the bay to hunt for reindeer. And on the way, killer whales came right round the boat. And I was astonished, and so was on the others, that this man, who obviously was absolutely scared stiff of these killer whales. And he started shouting. What was the Norwegian term he shouted? I don't remember the moment. We must get away, you can't stay here, they'll jump onto the boat and all. Oh, I can't remember his name. But anyway, he was the manager of the station. So I don't know what he thought was going to happen, but there was no problem with them. I didn't think there was a problem. Maybe they do on occasions do that, having seen them in South America, in South California, tamed and jumping up onto the thing. You know, but San Diego, I remember we went there a few years ago. I can see what they can do.
Well, there's, I think, concern that they might capsize a boat.
Oh, yes, this is a bit of a thing, because if it had, well, we're all in the water. But our boat did. That's another incident we had with a rowing boat in South Georgia. We went again over to the other side to shoot. What were we going to shoot that day? Yeah, we're going over to shoot reindeer. And the wireless operator was with us. He's from Liverpool, from the station. And I think Ian Biggs was with us too, and Jack Newing. And coming in to the shore, the quite a rough crossing, and the waves were fairly high. And I said, "No, you must keep that boat nose on or stern on to the wind, otherwise you're going to have a problem." And what do you call him? What's his name again? The wireless operator said, "Oh, I'll do the rowing," and he hadn't a clue how to handle a boat. With the result that he went side on and the boat capsized and threw us all into the sea, guns and all. And so much for a scouse, not knowing what to do. And that, I mean, we had to walk all the way back, and our clothes were rapidly stiff. And we lost the guns, but we went back. The boat drifted ashore. We went back and got her eventually, because it was a long, long trek away around back. Fortunately, we didn't have to do any high climbing. We could stay and walk along the shoreline. But things like that sort of happened from time to time. But
whilst you were at Deception, there was a South African boat that came in with there was a misunderstanding, I believe. The South African boat came in, thinking you'd be marooned.
Oh,
at
yeah,
Deception.
Yeah, that's right. We hadn't seen any ships for weeks, in a way. And all of a sudden, we saw a boat coming in, Neptune's Bellows, as we call it, the entrance into Deception. And looked like a whaler and came in, circled round, and we thought, oh, well, she'll be maybe dropping anchor and coming ashore. But no, she went way back out again. And just when she was going out, we got one very pistol. We had no party. And
A maroon.
Off it went. And then about a couple of minutes after, the boat came back in, turned around, and a small boat came ashore from her. He thought we were marooned. He had been the captain of a whaling ship 20 or something years ago, when the boats were lost in the harbour there. You know, they lost about 20 of them, and he'd come back to us to see what was what, and he thought that we'd been marooned there as well.
For 20 years?
South Africa. Well, not for 20 years, but he was from South Africa. So anyway, he gave us a bottle of Under Hum and something like that. And some bread and stuff, so, yes. The other thing was, remember he told you about the dogs in the well? Well, about a week after the Chilean ship had gone, having cleaned the well, we thought, Neville and I went to the well for water, because we hadn't to bug it out. And lo and behold, there were two dead dogs in the well again. Now, these were the Argentine dogs that, we don't know who the others, they must have been the Argentine as well. But why they landed in the well, I don't know. We thought, well, did they do this deliberately or what? But I presume they would have fallen in. And yet, there's quite a thing around it, so I don't know. We wondered if there was anything running in, you know, an underwater stream of any kind that would have got them. But we're quite surprised. The other two dogs dead.
When it came to leaving the Antarctic after your two winters down there, what were your feelings at that time, Alan?
Well, my feelings were that I wanted to go back.
Back where?
Back to the Antarctic. In fact, I signed on to FIDS asking to go back, and they had agreed. And lo and behold, I got home anyway. Eventually, we landed at Southampton. We were on the Spithead Review, Queen's Review of the Fleet, and we're all kitted out in uniforms. I lost all my whale teeth. We'd got our stack of whale teeth in South Georgia, and what's his name again? He had the bag with him. But he took it with him, and he supposed to share it with me at half and half, but I never got them.
Was this Arthur Martin?
No.
No, okay.
Arthur Mansfield? No.
Arthur Martin?
Martin, no. He went a year or two after that on an expedition to Mount Ararat to look for the Ark, because I saw his name mentioned. He died a couple of years ago. Oh, he was down there a couple of times, this fellow. Anyway, that was it, back home then after that.
So tell me about the Spithead Review. What do you remember of that?
Well, it's very interesting to see all the different ships, and we were alongside a big Russian, what is it called again, a massive battleship or some kind of cruiser. It was a flag-flying business. There were all kinds of things there, and just the Queen came out and a motorboat went right round the whole lot. That was the time, I think there was somebody caught diving under the Russian. Remember that incident when he was beheaded underwater because he'd been spying on the Russian ship at the time of the Spithead Review? So he was accused of that anyway. There was a big screed in the papers about it at the time. And probably he was doing some spying for whoever, MI5 or whoever they are. But it was a good, very interesting to be on it, really, that's right, and see all these ships from all the nations, from all over the world. Big sailing ships as well, some of them.
What happened to your quest to go south again? What happened to your quest to go south again?
Well, they were expecting me to be back down to join the Bisco again when she left again. But things changed when I got home.
Tell me.
Well, for one, my home was different. Because my father and mother, who never had much interest in church things, were now very involved. And so were other members of the family. So it was completely different. And I just thought, well, what am I going to do? Is this pressure on again? My father had a colleague who came up at the time to visit him. He was a headmaster in Greenock. And father invited him to the home and met him. And he was very interested in what was happening with me. So I think what he said to me, you know, more or less, was indicative that you couldn't run away all the time. You must answer the call. And so I said, yes, I will. So I notified Fates that I wouldn't be going back. And I started off on training. But initially, training for teaching, because I thought that might be a better course, because you can get quite good positions in religious education and so on. When I was finished that course, it was still obvious that it had to be something more than that. So I did my divinity course in Trinity College, Glasgow. And, I met Effie.
Your wife?
Yeah. And that more or less put an end to my wanderings.
Do you have any lasting regrets about not going south again, or is this the way that life pans out sometimes?
Not really, having thought it through. Obviously, you can never run away from something, in a sense, whatever it is. Some people run away from all kinds of things. And I found that very useful here, because shortly after I came here, they built a big place over at Kishon. They're building that massive platform for the oil industry. So I had to do the chaplaincy for that as well as here.
So you kind of understood the men, did you?
Oh, absolutely, because a great number of them had been running away and running away from all kinds of problems. I found that very useful. So,
did you at any time in the Antarctic, in such a pristine environment, did you feel close to God there at any time?
Absolutely.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, particularly, I would say, in the Argentine Islands, because the sheer beauty of the Allardyce, not the Allardyce Range, well, that was Sir George, of the other side and Greenland and that, I think it'd be difficult not to realise that there was the hand of a creator behind it all. And the beautiful, you know, sunrises and sunsets and the mountain ranges themselves, and I think all that had an influence, really. South Georgia certainly did as well. So, here I am.
The view from your window here is not too bad, is it?
Not too bad. If I could get some of these trees cut now. Yeah.
So, in some respects, going to the Antarctic kind of sealed your future for you, because although you went away for a while, it was whilst you were away that you had a second revelation. Is that true?
That's right. Well, I knew in Deception, funnily enough, that I just had to eventually give in. I tried something which I don't always tell people. I stopped praying. Stopped reading my Bible, which I read every day.
While she was south?
Yeah. I stopped. For what reason, I don't know, but I just stopped everything. And I had a strange experience, because I think I told you that probably I was the strongest man on the base, because I was used to haul. I lost all my strength. Absolutely. And I was in bed for several days. I just couldn't move, and I don't know why. But I said, well, get back to your praying and Bible, which I did, and I was back to normal in a day. So I think there was evidence there of something that sealed the whole thing. I tell that occasionally to people, but not tell you. Yeah.
Looking back over your career, your life, how important were those 2 years in the Antarctic to you, as on a scale of 1 to 10?
Oh, I think they were really number one, because of what I saw, what I felt, and the meeting with others and mixing with others and trying to cope with all the problems that arose. And I would say, yes, definitely it had, and particularly for the end of the day, my calling at this was something. Some people say, oh, you're on a what's a good... But they can't enter in, you see, to what you experienced yourself personally and what it means to you, what it meant to you.
So did those 2 years make you a better minister?
I would say so. Very interesting thing happened when I got back. A few days. The minister who walked, came into the hall on the night of the concert, came down to see me. He kept in touch with me while I was away. And the first greeting at the door was this: Jonah has come back. There you are.
It's been a real pleasure, Alan. Thank you very much indeed.
Oh, nice to meet you, and too.